This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. At the dawn of the rock and roll age, music culture was shaped by a range of colorful characters, perhaps none more so than the man they call the Killer.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill.
Jerry Lee Lewis, a blonde-haired piano player from the backwoods of Louisiana whose wild stage presence is almost as famous as the scandals that plagued his career. So when journalist and author Rick Bragg was offered the chance to meet Jerry Lee Lewis face-to-face and write his authorized biography, he jumped at the opportunity. Rick is a New York Times best-selling author, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and joins me now to talk about his latest work, Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. Rick Bragg, great to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
There have been very few books about Jerry Lee Lewis' life, none authorized by himself. Why did he authorize this book at this time?
I think he wanted to have his say. He wanted to have his say. He's knocking on 80.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to have his say. But it's an odd thing with Jerry Lee. He's the only man alive who'll tell you in 1 second, I want to have my say, and then tell you 15 seconds later, but I don't care what you think.
Well, did he care what people thought?
I think he cared that they thought he was the greatest piano player who ever lived. Mm-hmm. He cared that they thought he was a rock and roll idol. He cared about that. But beyond that recognition of his talent, he did what he wanted to do, and he didn't care what anybody thought.
And so he got that nickname, the Killer. Well, a piano player. Let's take us back to his earliest days and his love of the piano. Tell us about it.
Well, he was 5 years old, and he was walking through his Aunt Stella's house, and they have a piano because they're wealthy. Everybody else is dirt poor there. And he jumps up on the stool. His feet don't touch the floor, and he plays a song. The first time he ever touched the keys, he plays a song. And, you know, all his kinfolks gather around saying, you know, he's a progeny. And he just loves the thing. His daddy mortgages his farm there to buy him a piano. They call it the best investment in rock and roll history.
Well, what was his father thinking? I mean, because they were not wealthy folks. Is he buying that to, you know, to improve the cultural prospects for his son, or does he see this? There's a star in his future.
I think that he sees a star. Mm-hmm. You know, his daddy dreamed of being Jimmy Rogers. You know, he dreamed of singing on stage at the Opry or the Louisiana Hayride, and his boy. His boy is his real chance, because Elmo Lewis's life is going to be picking cotton and making whiskey, which, you know, he did time for twice. But his boy has a chance. I think he bought that piano thinking this could be our way out.
His youngest boy, Jerry Lee Lewis, had an older brother who he idolized and who was very different. Tell us about him and their relationship.
Well, you know, it's funny. He was kind of the good son. You know, he liked to go to school. Jerry Lee managed to skip most of the sixth grade. But he liked to go to school. He wrote songs. He sang in church. He had a beautiful voice. It's one of the things that makes this book so very Southern Gothic is the brother is playing in the yard of kinfolks and is run down by a drunk driver while his daddy, Elmo, is in prison for making whiskey.
Mm.
One of Jerry Lee's earliest memories is his daddy standing at the edge of a grave in shackles with two armed guards from the federal pen waiting nearby while they lay his older brother to rest.
So. This you have written a lot about the South and Southern culture, and your books are famous for that, and rightly so, and well known. And this, how much is this story a kind of quintessence of much of the kind of Southern culture that you've written about?
I think it is just permeated with. Again, I use the word Southern Gothic, but it's thick with the suffering and the tragedy of the Deep South and the Great Depression.
Well, there's a kind of separation too. That is this kind of you know, you talked about the good son, and
right.
that would make Jerry Lee Lewis the kind of evil twin,
right?
And this kind of dark side, and you know, coming in touch with the more creative side. Jerry Lee Lewis learns this music, the spirit of this music, from the juke joints in the black parts of his community.
Yeah, you know, the foundation, he says over and over and over again, is church, is the assembly of God. But, you know, it's Pentecostal church. So it's not this thick singing of hymns. It's they beat the mortal heck out of the piano. And so he has this foundation. But something was missing. There was a grit. There was a suffering missing from it. And he found that by sneaking in the front door of Haney's Big House, the most famous juke joint probably between Memphis and New Orleans. And he snuck in, did kind of a sideways slide under one of the tables and hid there among the patent leather shoes and listened to, you know, people like, you know, a young B.B. King. And you know, great blues singers like Big Joe Turner. And he hides there. And I asked him, I said, "What did you find under there?" And he said, "That's where I got my juice."
Hmm. What was it like to talk to him now? As you say, he's pushing 80. He's had some health problems.
Right.
What were those conversations like?
He was in bad shape when I got there. He has had crippling arthritis in his back. He recently had, 2 weeks ago, had surgery to clip some nerves so that he can sit on the piano bench, because
right.
That's what he really cares about. And but he was, you know, he had arthritis, he had shingles, he had pneumonia twice, he had a compound fracture in one leg that the infection almost killed him to intensive care and critical condition. So he slowed down enough for me to kind of pin him down. And he lay in his bed in kind of the cool dark there in North Mississippi at his ranch. And I sat in a rocking chair, which I've joked about is rapidly becoming my favorite mode of transportation. And I sat there and we talked about the past. We talked about everything bad, everything heartbreaking. And some days we laughed out loud.
You mentioned the important role that religion, this Pentecostal religion, played in his life. His brother's Jimmy Swaggart. His cousin is Jimmy Swaggart. So this all plays an important role in his life. And his deep sense and fear that what he was doing, he couldn't stop himself, but he's playing the devil's music, and there's a price to pay for that.
Right, exactly. It's been called by a lot of writers, it's been called an unfathomable religion. But I think that's been called that by people who have never seen the Holy Ghost invade a person's body, seen them twitch, seen them fall to the floor and thrash, seen them roll, seen them. I grew up Pentecostal, admittedly backslid many, many, many times, but seen people walk the backs of pews like a tightrope. So Jerry Lee Lewis grew up knowing that there's two directions. You can either walk in glory, or you can burn in a lake of fire. But the worst part is one of the tenets, and he believes this, of his faith, is that if you go to hell, it will be as if you were never known. And can you imagine a deeper hell for Jerry Lee Lewis than for the people who loved him, all those people who loved him, to have never known?
He loses his kleos. This is epic. This goes back to the Odyssey, right? I mean, you lose your reputation and it's all gone. There is, I think, a remarkable quote in your book that he tells you about a conversation he had with Elvis. And it's at a time, there's a great photo in the book too. Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, and Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis. And at that session, he asked him a question. And in fact, we actually have the audio of that question. Let's listen.
I had a chance to talk with Elvis one time up here, and we sang a long time. I think there's a picture back there of me and him and Johnny and Carl. And the last thing I said to Elvis was that he was walking out the door. We'd been playing and jamming for about 5 or 6 hours. I asked him, I said, Elvis, I want to ask you one thing before you leave. This is on my mind. I just like to know. If you died, do you think you'd go to heaven or hell? And his eyes got real big, and he looked at me, and he said, Jerry, don't you ever ask me that again or ever say that to me again. I didn't mean anything by it because I knew he was raised in the same church I was, and I just wanted his opinion of what he thought about it. And apparently it scared him. I know it had me scared, and it still does.
As Jerry Lee Lewis, you can see the print edition of that quote in Rick Bragg's new book, Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. Rick Bragg is with me today. Is he still worried about that?
Every day. Every day. He is preparing himself for that question. He prays before he eats. He prays before he goes to sleep. He kneels and prays. He tithes, but more than anything, he lives every day with that question. It's not an intellectual question. It's not a philosophical question. It is a question of reward or never ending agony.
It's so interesting that most of it, it's from what I've seen in the book, centers on his fear that this is somehow the devil's music and he was doing the devil's work. I mean, is that true? Is that where
he
most
still
of
struggles? Head? Yeah, absolutely. Because he does believe this. He has come to this, that there is a great joy in what he's brought to people through this music. His mama told him, you can lift the blues off people. So as it turns out, the music was the purest part of all this.
And interestingly enough, one of the things that he is most criticized for and that many in this culture would consider a sin was being married to his 13-year-old cousin.
Right. But see, that too is and I know a lot of people will snort at this, but by the conventions of his upbringing of place and time, to marry a 13-year-old was commonplace. To marry your cousin, let alone your third cousin, which is almost like no cousin at all, right, in Jerry Lee's way of looking at it, it was commonplace. And his sister, Linda Gale, married at 12. And so, no, he didn't see that as anything wrong. And, you know, a half century later, longer, he still doesn't.
He came back from a tour in England where it became known, had an impact on that tour. Was not well received in England by all objective accounts. He got back here and was asked about that. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Jerry, what about this reception in London? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, sir. We had a very good reception, sir.
Oh, is that so?
Yes, we had a very nice time, and the people treated us real nice.
Well, the papers reported that you were greeted with silence over there and with catcalls from the audience. Is that right?
Well, I can't agree with them there, sir. Uh-huh. The audience was very nice and very good.
Mm-hmm. Why did you leave?
Well, I don't answer those questions, sir. My manager might knock my head off or something.
When were you married?
Pardon?
When were you married?
Well, we leave our personal questions out of this, sir.
All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
There's Jerry Lee Lewis. I'm talking to Rick Bragg today. He's written Lewis' biography, Jerry Lee Lewis, in his own words. It was a great tour, huh?
Yeah. You know, the thing about Jerry Lee is he really believed that it was never the fans, never the people who went away from him. In London, in England, he really believed that if he'd had just a little more time, that he would have won them over. And of course, people blame the media for everything then and now, but it's almost sport. But the newspapers savaged him. The London newspapers not only savaged him, but they had fun doing it. Mm. And he really believed that that was the condemnation, that the people who filled the seats, and he really believed that if he'd had a little more time, he could have won them back. He could have played his way and sang his way out of it. And he came home believing that, only to find that they were smashing his records and that people like Dick Clark, for instance, had turned away from him. And he still believed, I can win them back. Mm. So he loaded 3 dusty Cadillacs up full of guitar pickers and drum sets, and he went on the road. And he played every school auditorium and every honky-tonk, places with chicken wire, and, covering the stage. And he played and he played and he played. And in some ways, he still is.
Talking to Rick Bragg today, his new book, Jerry Lewis, His Own Words, talking to him today on The State of Things. He was poised to become the new king. And in fact, there was a moment at which Elvis was about to hand him that crown. Tell us about it.
Right. Well, Elvis had been drafted. And he and Colonel Parker put a brave face on it. But Elvis was wrecked by that possibility. He did not believe that he could return after a year and a half or 2 years and still have the life that he had. Jerry Lee had 4 songs in the top 100. Jerry Lee was already being crowned in newspaper stories and wire service reports as the new king, as the crown prince of rock and roll. And Jerry Lee had gotten his draft notice too, but he wadded it up and threw it in the Black River. Elvis, being the sweet boy that he was, not only went, but he said, I don't want to be treated any different. That was a strategy, to keep the public with him. I don't want to be treated any different. I don't want to be the singing G.I.
Mm-hmm.
But it wrecked Elvis. And Elvis shows up at Sun Records in the middle of the day. It's not like it's been portrayed in the past where, the two men meet in a dark room. But Elvis came to Sun Records, walked through the door, in the middle of the day with session men and secretaries and Sam Phillips in a crowded studio there on Union Avenue in Memphis, walked up to Jerry Lee and said, take it. And then just broke down and sobbed and tears rolled down his face. And most people would have said, there, Elvis. But Jerry Lee just looked at him and said, I didn't know it meant so much to you. And what he meant was not a cruelty. What he meant was that Elvis had gone Hollywood. Elvis had pulled away, in Jerry Lee's eyes,
mm-hmm.
from that kind of drive-in rockabilly, that blues and gospel and country, hillbilly-driven rock and roll that was the birth of it all, man, that took that great blues that had been around forever and made it accessible suddenly to a wider audience. And it was, Sam Phillips put his arm around Elvis's shoulders and led him away. So told Jerry Lee, that's all right, Elvis gets emotional.
Lots more great stories in this book. We're out of time right now, but I want to thank you, Rick, so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Rick Bragg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, New York Times best-selling author. The new authorized biography of Jerry Lee Lewis is Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. Rick is going to be reading from the biography tonight, 7 o'clock, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Tomorrow, 10 a.m., McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh. And you can find out the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, live music from Chris Staples. Stay tuned.